Thank you. Okay. So, thanks a lot to organizers for inviting me. In a certain sense, I have already half of the work done. I must thank Alex for the introduction to the subject. So, in any case, let me insist on some ideas. Yesterday, in particular, we saw that quantum cosmology is having a lot of success in analyzing quantum mechanically homogeneous models, but for the moment being, this is like the frontier. Okay, we want to go beyond that and include inhomogeneities in order to have something to say for physical cosmology, observational cosmology. On the other hand, there has been a lot of progress in understanding some cosmologies with infinite number of degrees of freedom, the Gaudi cosmologies in particular, but this has been done using a standard for quantization. Okay. As Alex explained, in a certain sense, the natural model to consider in this context is the Gaudi model with the topology of a strict torus and what is called linear polarization. This means essentially two Killing vector fields are hypersurface orthogonal. In this case, the simplest idea that one can introduce or adhere to is to try to combine all things of quantization in order to get the best of both of them, to get a full quantization of the system with an infinite number of degrees of freedom, but that includes at least some elements of loop quantum gravity that has something to say about the quantum geometry, and in particular with respect to the resolution of singularities. Okay. This has like a complementary perspective from the point of view of the results of loop quantum cosmology for homogeneous models. The question is how robust these results are about the resolution of the singularity when you include fields or in general infinite number of degrees of freedom. Okay. So by analyzing a hybrid quantization, we can say things about that. The other thing, at least in this case, in which you have a compact topology and therefore you have global degrees of freedom in the system, my idea is to try to see whether just the loop quantization of them is sufficient to resolve the singularities. This simplest approach to the BKL approach that would have to consider something like a homogeneous cosmology at each point. Well, here we're trying to see whether just the quantum geometry effects on global modes are sufficient in a certain sense to resolve. There are other questions motivating the analysis. I will just consider a Gaudi model in a vacuum. So this means that we will not introduce matter fields. In particular, this will allow us to discuss things about the emergent time, the internal time, without having to introduce the standard scalar field that has been used in homogeneous loop quantum cosmology. And this will be also positive to learn some lessons about what is the role of time and how much our results depend on that. Okay. There are issues like what is a semi-classical behavior of the simplified loop quantum cosmology that arises from here. An important issue is what is the validity of a fog quantization when you are using loop quantum techniques, how you can arrive to a regime in which the fog quantization is valid. And obviously also for the treatment of inhomogeneities is to develop perturbative approaches, okay, to deal with them. In this sense, the philosophy is try to obtain a full quantization and learn from there, instead of assuming that you have a regime of validity of your perturbative approximation, is trying to derive them if possible. Okay, sorry. So by now, the Gaudi model is familiar for all of us. The only thing that we are changing parametrization is the time that it appears, but apart from that,
we know they correspond to spacetimes, with two space-like Killing vector fields that are axial. And in the case of the Godel cosmologies, the compact, the spatial sections have compact topology, and we are going to analyze the three torus topology, which is the simplest one. As I said before, also, I'm considering linear polarization, so this means that the two Killing vector fields are hypersurface orthogonal. And you can write the classical metric explicitly. You can find the solution explicitly, the most general solution. The metric depends only on the time and one coordinate on the circle. In fact, the only degree of freedom is a field, pi that appears here. These two coordinates would be, let's say, corresponding to the two Killing vector fields, and the area induced on the isometry orbits can be chosen as a time coordinate. Okay, this is the T that appears there. Then you have a conformal factor for the metric induced on the set of isometry orbits, and this can be solved as a functional of this field is set for a zero mode. That is also a degree of freedom of the system. And you have the classical solution in terms of Bessel functions. Generically, the origin of time is a singularity, curvature singularity for these solutions. Okay. And you see that you have an infinite number of degrees of freedom. So it has all the ingredients that are interesting for us now. What we have done in order to analyze it, quantum mechanics, first introduce, just a Hamiltonian formalism and do a partial gauge fishing. The diffeomorphism gauge freedom is totally fixed except for one global degree of freedom that has to do with translations in the circle parameterized by this coordinate. This was more or less explained by Alejandro. And the other thing is that in principle you could completely deparameterize the system if it's in the time gauge, but in order to be able to develop a loop quantization, we want to have at least a Hamiltonian constraint. Okay. So we will just fix the time gauge except for a global degree of freedom. Essentially, what we are going to do is just to fix the sections of constant time, but not given the time function. So this will be, this T will be treated as a global degree of freedom zero mode. Okay. When you do that, you can prove that the gauge system is well posed, and then this is just simply the field parametrization of the metric that we are going to use. So let me explain a little bit. Essentially, the field has been prescaled conveniently so that we have the same field that was used in the fog quantization of the system, and we have already extracted from it the zero mode. So all the fields that appear here don't have zero modes. The same thing happens with this conformal factor, and now we have three global modes that correspond to the zero mode of this field, zero mode of gamma, and the one representing the time, so these are three. And this corresponds essentially to the three scale factors in Bianchi 1 of Kasner. Okay? And so I have already adopted the parametrization that is used for Bianchi 1, so that when this field vanishes, so does this tilde gamma, and you obtain a parametrization for Bianchi 1 metric. Okay. So for Bianchi 1, we are going to use the same kind of variables that are used in loop quantum cosmology, in particular the P variables for the density tri and the C. We are already choosing a particular position metric. In this case, we have a natural coordinate cell because we are in the three torus. The other thing is that for the fields, what we are doing is just expanding them in Fourier modes. Remember that we have a circle topology. And then assign to them annihilation and creation light variables that were the ones used for the fog quantization, in fact. Although Alejandro was using a different notation, I think it was a B, but are the same. Okay. Now, the Fock quantization that was introduced for the Gaudi model was that corresponding to a choice of complex structure such that these variables were promoted to annihilation and creation operators in a natural world. And remember that in a certain sense, it's a natural Fock quantization to consider for the system, so we're going just to adopt it, okay, and develop our quantization just combining it with the loop quantization of the CO. Okay. Now, the system, as I said before, has still two constraints left remaining. One corresponds to the deformorphism in the theta direction and generate translations in the circle. The reason why this has not been get fixed and removed essentially is because otherwise you will destroy the linearity in your covariant phase space. So it's better to retain it and deal with it quantum mechanically. The other thing is that this constraint does not include the global modes, the zero modes, okay? So it's something that has to do with the Fock part of the system. Now, we have not completely fixed the time gauge, and this means that we still have just one Hamiltonian constraint that corresponds to the average of the Hamiltonian with the unit Laplace function. So it's the integrated Hamiltonian constraint. It has two parts. One that is the one corresponding to, or the one that you would obtain if all the inhomogeneities, the modes of the field, were equal to zero. And it's simply the Hamiltonian constraint of Bianchi 1. Okay. And the other contribution includes, well, all the contribution of the field and its momentum, so all the homogeneities. You have two parts, one corresponding to, you can interpret it as a free scalar field, and the other part is essentially the potential that Alejandro was talking about. See that the field is square, and the time does not appear explicit here because we have not fixed it completely, but essentially a variable that would play the role of time is just this P1. Okay. So this part of the Hamiltonian contains all the non-trivial part, including the time dependence and the possible creation of particles, although here you don't have any matter field. Okay, so the interpretation of particles is not peculiar. The other thing is that the Hamiltonian is written there is the one that, let's say, has not been densitized in the typical procedure. It's, in a certain sense, a natural one because it's the one coming from loop quantum gravity. And the other thing is that, although here it will be no problem, but one has to be careful because when you have an infinite number of degrees of freedom, the densitization process can really change the ultraviolet behavior. So for resolution singularity could be something relevant.
So when Alex gave the talk, I think the mass was time dependent.
Yeah, it is this part here. It's a field square, and this is like the time. So it's like psi square divided by t square. Apart from scaling by a constant of motion. So this part that has to do with the quantization of Bianchi 1 that was adopted, in principle, is just to have a Hilbert space that is a tensor product of one corresponding to each of the directions for Bianchi 1. The kinematical Hilbert space is that of a square integral function on the compactification of the real line with the hard measure corresponding to that compactification. And the thing here, let me explain this a little bit. We implemented what is called Chu's proposal, is that in the improved dynamics, the new parameter is essentially
the inverse of the square root of the p variable. Conceptually, there is nothing important for the rest of the discussion that depends on this. The important thing, at least from our point of view, is that it will allow us to complete the quantization. And there were a lot of issues for which it's essential for us and for our motivation that we can give a quantum answer to them. Okay. So getting abstracted in the process just by, let's say, complications that had to do with one implementation or the other was not the purpose. So this is something that one can always try at the end of the day just to see what happens if you change the perspective. Okay. In this case, the thing of life is simple because you can just change from the typical new basis in loop quantum cosmology to the V basis in each of the directions. And essentially, it's a fine parameter corresponding to translation by mu bar c. And in there, essentially posing all the quantum mechanical problems will be quite easy. Now, the first part is just to concentrate on the part of the Hamiltonian constraint that corresponds only to these global modes, to be anti-1, and we obtain a Hamiltonian of that kind with this prescription. And here you have like two kind of operators. One is just the regularization of the private operator following Tiemann's trick. The way to arrive to this Hamiltonian is the standard one, using the standard definition of the curvature operator and of the inverse of the determinant of the metric. So you are right there. You have this regularized operator by Tiemann's trick. And then this is the only thing which we introduce a particular factor ordering that I consider is especially appropriate because of several things. The first one is that it really, in a certain sense, decouples each direction. Okay, the directions are decoupled among them. Since the absolute value of p is a positive operator, you can take the square root of it, and then, as you see here, you can get a symmetric ordering just by adopting the one that appears there. The other thing, the other subtlety, is that in principle there are signs concerning coming from the p's, okay, that are included in these operators. So you have to take them into account to arrive to this symmetric operator. Now, with this ordering, there is something that is straightforward to see. The first thing is that all states in the span of V, let's say states, okay, tensor products of them, for which one of the V at least is equal to zero, they are annihilated by this constraint. It is so because the regularized triad operator annihilates them, and also they are annihilated here, as you've seen, okay. But furthermore, the orthogonal complement, I mean, you just get the span of this, and you complete it with the inner product that you have in your kinematic auxiliary space, and then you get the orthogonal complement of it. And you can see that orthogonal complement is invariant under the action of this Hamiltonian. Okay, this has a diagonal action in P states. And here, if you could contact with a V equal to zero state, okay, it will be killed, annihilated by this part there. So the orthogonal complement is invariant. So this means that the Hamiltonian has a well-defined projection on this orthogonal complement. And from that point of view, at that moment, you can already say that states corresponding to singularity are at least decoupled in a kinematical sense. Okay? This does not mean that you don't have a resolution of the singularity in a stronger sense in the model. Okay? And in fact, we can comment later about some numerical simulations in a simplified version of the model, in which you can find bounces, okay. But at least kinematically, you already have this decoupling, okay, in the system. And this is straightforwardly, well,
or this at least allow you to have a better control on the densitization of the Hamiltonian. The first thing is that at that moment, you restrict all your consideration to that orthogonal complement I was speaking about before. And there, the triad, regularized triad operator is invertible, okay? Because you have removed the zero eigenvalue state that was really a proper surface. On the other hand, you can see you are considering, for instance, for solutions, the algebraic dual of a dense set in which the regularized inverse volume operator and its inverse, okay, are well defined as a simply least invariant your domain of definition there, your dense set, then you can see that in this algebraic dual, essentially this operator there gives you a one-to-one correspondence. So you have a real correspondence between solutions to one of the Hamiltonian constraints and to the other, the densitized version. Okay. And therefore, you just go to the densitized version, which is much simpler. And you continue working in the same kinematical space as before. Okay. That's why it appears in this symmetry. You can adopt other factor ordinates, but remember, okay, that it's important that you have already coupled those states that were annihilated by this operator. Otherwise, you cannot change the measure just in places where precisely this operator vanishes because then the measures are not mutually equivalent. Okay, so by doing this, we arrive to this form of the Hamiltonian. It's extremely nice from a computational point of view in the sense that your problem has been reduced just to a one-dimensional problem. You only have one operator. So you just consider that operator, and you have essentially, you want to do functional analysis of the Hamiltonian constraint, you have to consider only that operator there, which is in one dimension. It has a form as appears there. So what it does is, given a state V, it gives a contribution or a shift by an elementary step of 2 in the positive direction and another contribution with the same shift but in the negative direction. Now, these contributions are multiplied by a function in which the signs that I referred to before, above, okay, appear. And this is important because of the following. Well, the first thing is because of the definition operator, you see that you will get like irreducible representation just in lattices of points that are separated by this elementary step of 2, okay. But apart from that, if you want to connect the positive and negative semi-axis, at that moment, you will have to get a V between 0 and 2, and then you can check that the two signs that appear here are different. And so this means that the two semi-axes are not connected. Okay? So this operator will leave invariant, will have irreducible representations on the Hilbert spaces corresponding to these semilattices. And you just choose a point in the interval 0 or to 2, and then point separated from them by a step of 2, and the other things whether you are in the positive or in the negative semi-axis. That's all. In this sense, at least you can say, you consider this as super selection sectors for your theory. You can say that there is a kind of no bounding in the sense that the two different triad orientations are not connected in the theory. You can restrict your consideration just to one of the orientations.
Do you have in your case this problem?
No. You will see in a moment that everything is okay. We have nothing. Here you don't have it. Yeah. So, a couple of comments about this. Well, the first thing is that The operator as such is a difference operator, okay, but it's a second order in the sense that it relates three different slices. But however, because of this property, you can see that, for instance, you are considering again states. They are completely fixed by their value in the first point in the semi-lattice. So you only need one piece of data, not two. This is important in a certain sense because of the following. Well, when you consider generic, again, functions for it, this is a plot Thomas obtained. So the things that you start, for instance, with a value of 1 in the first slice, and then the operator is changing from real to imaginary values at each fundamental step. So there is a really fast changing phase. When you consider it, you see that the, let's say that the semi-classical limit of the operator, okay, for large values of B is a second order differential operator, while the Wheeler-DeWitt analog of it will be a first order operator. In a certain sense, and this, I'm just referring to large B, certain sense this is good because it's allowing you to have both incoming and outgoing waves, even if your operator was of first order class. Otherwise, coming around would be difficult.
What is the
These are the eigen functions of the operator. Okay.
So, in this plot, lambda is this, it's, you're just plotting
the. Yeah, in this case, it was 500. No problem. This is a typical like kind of behavior. The other thing is that you can analyze the operator just with Kato techniques. I'm using the results by Eureka and his students, and then prove that the operator is essentially self-adjoint. Okay, yes, the domain of definition corresponded to the semi-lattice. And furthermore, that the spectrum is just absolutely continuous and is given by the real line. Okay, so you will have the composition of the identity of this kind.
So these are results.
No, for this operator. The operator that appears in our case. But the physics is just given by a piece of data in the initial slice, for instance, or since you have really the composition of the identity here, any slice will do exactly as well. So it's like a kind of interplay between both things. You are not changing the physics, but you're having the properties that you need in order to have kind of bounds. Okay, and so essentially this is like the typical story. Now that you have the spectral decomposition of this operator is easy to solve the Hamiltonian constraint. For instance, you can apply group averaging, and then you obtain the physical Hilbert space, okay, for the system.
So, for the moment, you're just ignoring the inequality.
Yeah. So the next step is just to include the inhomogeneities here. And so, essentially, because of the interaction, the kinematical Hilbert space will be the tensor product, okay, of the Yankee one with the Fokker space for the inhomogeneous one. Again, something similar was what happens with the Bianchi one occurs here, and you can decouple the zero volume space and then go just to the orthogonal complement, and you will have this kinematic space. And now you have the whole Hamiltonian constraint, not only the Bianchi one part, but also the one including the inhomogeneous models.
And you have multiplied that inhomogeneous part also by the 1 upon square root of. Both sides.
Yeah. So it's just, that's also important here. You are just multiplying by this square root of P1, P2, P3, which are, yeah. And it gives you also, in this sense, the factor ordering how to do it both sides in the same way. Okay. Now, the thing that is just a prescription, it's not coming from loop quantum gravity, is how to represent in this part, okay, including the homogeneities, in the variables C and P. So for C, there were C2P2 and C3P3, and the proposal is just to adopt the same kind of representation as in the Bianchi 1 part, and this leads you to Dirac observables of the theory at that moment. And then for P1, the more or less the standard prescriptions, okay? And here you see clearly that lambda 1 and P1, they are not Dirac observables anymore, and that P1 is playing the role of time, okay? While these two directions, in a certain sense, are trivial for the system. And you have a free field Hamiltonian and a kind of interaction Hamiltonian coming from this potential, this time mass. Okay. Now, you, given the analysis that we have for the Bianchi 1, now you have the super selection sector that is given by the tensor product of things. And in certain sense, I don't know whether it's remarkable or not, for me it is, so there was no warranty that you can define the Hamiltonian constraint, given that you have an infinite number of degrees of freedom using these hybrid techniques. And the result is that at least we have a domain of definition in which really the Hamiltonian constraint is well defined and symmetric, okay? This is given by the tensor product of the V states in the, I mean, different from zero, and by the M particle states for the fourth partition. And you can prove this dense set. You can prove that the constraint is well defined there. So the next step would be to prove the essential self-adjointness, and in this part, really, we have not completed it, but in a certain sense, the problem is that we are lacking motivation to face the problem, which is not trivial, in the following sense. The domain that I have shown to you is not invariant under the action of the Hamiltonian constraint. If you want to apply a group averaging, you need really a domain that is invariant. And afterwards, you will also need to see that you have an appropriate topology for the implementation of the group averaging. And here, simply, I admit that we don't know how to do that. Okay, the domain is far from invariant. There's no way of seeing what would be here a invariant domain for that Hamiltonian constraint. Obviously, the interaction part that creates an infinite number of pairs of particles. This is what essence is. Sure. This creates an infinite number of pairs, and therefore, if you start with an M particle state, okay, first step, you already have an infinite. It's not there. It's not the. If it's easy, I don't know how to do it. Okay, so this clear abstraction for applying the group averaging. So what we did is just the other option, trying to find the solutions to the constraint. So formally we expand, we consider just the general eigenvalue equation. That's why this value of complex eigenvalue appears there. So for solution it will be zero, and we just get a formal expansion, okay, adopting already lambda 2 and lambda 3, which are the eigenvalues in the two directions that are trivial, these are course of motion. And then finding the solution is not so difficult. You realize that in the Hamiltonian constraint, essentially the operator corresponding to lambda 1 gives you contribution, let's say, on one section, and in another one that is separated by two fundamental steps. Okay. And the rest of operators there just give a contribution in the intermediate slice. Okay. Starting from the original, the initial section, then you realize that if you want to give the value of the solution in any other section, the only thing that you have to consider is all possible, let's say, paths to arrive to the section either by jumps of one fundamental step or two fundamental steps, and each, in each case applying the corresponding operator, and that's all. So this is essentially what is written there in a cryptic language, but this is the way of obtaining it. Okay. So this formula, because of, I mean, essentially, it does not live in the algebraic dual of the domain that we had for our operator, just because of the problem with creation of pairs of particles. Even so, there are three things that I think are worth commenting. The first thing is that the solution is just totally determined by the value of this state in the first section. Okay, so in this sense, just data in that initial section are sufficient. Different question is whether the data in any other section really determine your solution. In principle, from this point of view, this would be to ask whether this complicated operator here is invertible. In general, I would say that the chances are few, but so it may be that you don't have, other sections that would not allow you to determine the solutions. Also related to that is the fact that at least with these choices, the projections on given sections, as I said before, are not well defined, in the sense that we don't know what is the rigorous house for them, where they live. This, in a certain sense, also indicated that there may be a non-locality, okay, in this. And this corresponds to eigenvalues of V1, so a non-locality in V1. So, we have seen in any case that there is an initial section, but we want to ask questions about how it evolves in V1, maybe this is not possible, finally, in the quantum theory. I'm just also saying this because both the issue of non-locality and what would be the consequences about how to redefine the bounds, so that it's we have a question that is well posed in the theory, okay, can be relevant in systems that have an infinite number of degrees of freedom. Okay, I'm almost finishing. So, if we identify solution with those initial data now, it's quite easy and trivial. We have observables, the ones corresponding to Bianchi 1. And for the homogeneous mode, we can choose the coefficients of the sine and cosine expansion of the filament momentum. Okay. And so we implement the reality conditions that this observer should be essentially self-adjoint. Essentially, this allows us to fix the Hilbert space, the physical Hilbert space. We still have there the generator of translation is one as a constraint. We can now implement it, and it will lead us simply to a proper subspace of this focus space, which is just the kernel of our quantum constraint. Okay. So from that point of view, we arrive to a physical Hilbert space in which the Fock quantization is recovered, at least in a certain sense. Okay. Okay, so just general conclusions. Obviously, I have the impression that there are a lot of open avenues from here. But at least what we have seen is that it's possible to adopt this kind of hybrid techniques. It allows you to deal with complicated problems in not such a complicated way and to extract lessons and even conclusions. The other thing for me is it's quite remarkable that we have been able to combine these two completely different kinds of quantization and obtain a well-defined Hamiltonian constraint. Okay. We have seen also that the initial singularity is avoided even with this infinite number of degrees of freedom, okay, at least kinematically. If Thomas can explain more detail if you want, but we have been running also numerical simulations in the simplified version of the model. And essentially for inhomogeneities that are not too big, you will obtain bounces. And there are also bounds on where these bounces are poor in comparison with the Bianchi one.
And the other thing is that we have been able to show that at least to some extent one is able to recover the fog quantization from techniques that include the loop quantization. So possible things that one can do once that one has obtained this kind of quantization is in there, one can prove perturbative methods, one can compare the general quantization with those coming from these perturbative formulations. Okay. And other things that are also, let's say, in mind is to analyze the time evolution in the system. Okay. So that's all. How we define them. Here they are formal. There is a way of defining them. There is, you can introduce a cutoff, okay, and then just ask the solutions to have projections. Yes. So it's an identification of solutions with initial data. That's what I was saying. You identify the. You are right. The other thing that was trying to say, you won't be going to reduce the cutoff, and then you will be obtaining physical spaces for each value of the cutoff, and then you remove the cutoff, and the limit you obtain there. That's like a limit that you take, and you see that the two procedures give exactly the same answer.
Okay.
Yeah. After getting the physical. So it's like a limit of Hilbert spaces in which you are enlarging your solutions.
So what do we know about the constraint? Symmetric object.
Yeah, it's well defined symmetric. The proof is not completed about the essential self-agreement, so I cannot tell you that it's essential self-agreement. I mean, all indications are that it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. No. I mean, obviously, the problem from that point of view, and that's why all the complications come from there, is that this domain is not invariant. Actually, you are looking for something. It's invariant that the action of the Hamiltonian has to be really different. Essentially, the thing is that since the mass is time dependent, at each section you will have like the natural fog quantization, natural definition of particles will correspond to a different mass. Although they are unitarily equivalent, but they are different definitions of particles. And now for the Hamiltonian constraint, you have to consider the collection of all of them. So, complications come clearly from there. I mean, you have just n particles of one time, and you act with your Hamiltonian constraint. Obviously, you will not obtain the same kind of n particle states. Well, there were some words on the Ohmic string, just considering, I mean, in the sense that you have S1 topology and time, and you can consider this a kind of wall shape. The problem with this, as with anything else, compared to our quantization, is what is for you, let's say, the fundamental thing, the fundamental field that you're going to quantize. Here we are adopting a fog quantization in which, as Alejandro explained, there's a particular choice of field. If you adopt a different field, you will not have the same properties for the fog quantization. So, I'm not saying that you cannot do it. Okay. Simply that it will lead you to a different physics. Sure. Right.
It's this one, okay?
This one. So, I mean, supposing I was not looking at Yankee 1 quantized LR loop techniques, and I was just looking at what Alex told us this morning. We just quantized everything using Fox space. Then this Hamiltonian is supposed to be essentially self-adjoint, or in fact self-adjoint.
I mean, the thing there is that you can, if you want, so you can deparametrize the theory. I mean, if you want to say it a different way, you will have a 10-dependent Hamiltonian. Okay, this essentially self-adjoint for each value of 10. And then you can prove that the evolution of the gene is in the chain. But it's not exactly the same, in the sense that here you have the collection of all of them. Okay.
This is what I'm confused about.
I mean, essentially, it's the difference of.
Suppose, I mean, if I just looked at that Hamiltonian, it's like the homogeneous term is coming from.
It's the difference of treating the time as a parameter of an operator. This is essentially it. If it were a parameter, I can prove it. That is essentially a function.
So, what is this key dependence?
P1. Whether you can deparametrize it, even here if you want, you can do it. I mean, the only thing is affecting the loop quantization of this mode. Okay?
Yeah.
But you could.
But there's no, that's what one has to think through. You're saying there's no obstruction to that.
You could deparametrize the theory. Okay. So at that moment, you will get essentially the same kind of quantization that we have.
Why? I could deparametrize it and yet treat the homogeneous modes, the remaining homogeneous mode,
you could.
Loop techniques.
Yeah, although in here they are essentially, they are constant motions, okay, so, but you could.
So I'm still confused. So I could have done the way that Alex was doing.
Yes.
Deparametrizing it classically, then decomposing it into the homogeneous modes and inhomogeneous modes. And saying that the homogeneous ones are going to be quantized using loopy techniques, because then there's discreteness of geometry and something like some singularity resolution might come about, and I treat the inhomogeneous modes using the Fock techniques exactly as you have done. And it seems to me that maybe there is some subtle obstruction, but if there is no subtle obstruction already in the homogeneous section, there might be some subtle obstruction. But if there isn't, then it would seem to me that one should be able to really
the parametrization essentially, okay, apart from the convenience of some risk calling by constant motion, but here you will have something like T delta T, okay, multiplied by these two constant motions, 102, 102. And here you will have 1 over T1 and here T1.
Sorry, T.
And you can put the Hamiltonian, so it's like a Schrödinger equation, and the Hamiltonian you obtain there, you can prove that first is self-adjoint for each value of t, and more importantly, that the classical evolution that it generates can be implemented quantum mechanically in any unitary. But it's not the same operators here, because of the different way of dealing with the time. One case and the other.
But then, even in that case, you have these terms, you look like interacting.
Yeah.
And you could also have this property that it does not leave.
Yes. I mean, in a certain sense, that's the good and non-trivial thing, okay, of what we proved in the Fock quantization, that they are the evolutions well-defined in the chain. And it's not so obvious because of what
you're saying. So therefore that is not really an abstraction. So
not there. Maybe we're simply losing techniques to deal with these other kind of problems.
Yeah, this is always controversial because I have heard personally 20 years I have heard of so many interpretations of no boundary that I don't know which one to compare. Okay, here what I mean is that you don't have to consider the two orientations of the tray and you do not have to include any boundary condition. Just for instance at vanishing eigenvalue of the train. You don't have to include any additional physical information. Everything is given there just by your geometric operators. You don't have to include any additional thing. In this sense, the operator I was commenting before, this lambda one, really it is a second order difference operator. But however, the eigenstates are fixed by one piece of data. I don't have to include an additional physical information about the other piece of it.
So I think the problem is over parentheses. I think he's saying there is no boundary condition.
Yeah.
That was true.
Yes.
No boundary condition.
Originally, that was also the intention of the no boundary condition. There was no boundary. But people have interpreted it in quite different ways. So in this sense, so that there is no misinterpretation, my personal opinion in this thing I have no problem being controversial is that the standard no boundary condition has not a Wood definition. Okay, so that's why you have problems in comparing with it. Here at least I think that what we mean by no boundary is clear. I don't have to include any additional piece of information, just the operator, the function analysis of it tells you all the information.